Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And by Antioch University New England, offering doctoral degrees in clinical psychology, environmental studies, and marriage and family therapy, as well as master's degrees and certificates. antioch.edu/nhradio.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The Winter Olympics are back, bringing audiences the beauty and thrill of sports on the ice and snow. But while we watch Olympians ski on perfectly groomed slopes or skate on impeccable indoor arenas, a growing number of New Hampshire cold weather athletes are seeking a rougher, closer to nature vibe. Backcountry skiing is taking off, with more people wanting to hike up that big mountain and then ski back down. As one enthusiast told the Concord Monitor, you may only get one run in the day, but you'll remember every single turn. New Hampshire's White Mountain National Forest and Vermont's Green Mountains are both engaging with this growing ski group, from where to cut trees to how to avoid triggering an avalanche. Today in The Exchange, we find out more, and later we'll check in on another longtime winter sport, not for the faint of heart, ice climbing. Let's hear from you, too. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Joining us by phone, Tyler Ray. He's the Granite Chief of the Granite Backcountry Alliance, a group that promotes greater access and development for backcountry skiing. Tyler, great to have you. Thanks for your time.
Hey, Lord, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Also with me in studio, Andrew Drummond, who runs Ski the Whites, an alpine touring equipment outfitter. Andrew also runs events and a retail shop at the Black Mountain Ski Area in Jackson. And Andrew, thank you for coming in. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
So why backcountry skiing, Andrew, you first, instead of regular downhill skiing? What makes this, in your opinion, more fun?
It really draws upon all the things I like about the mountains. I like being out in the outdoors. I like hiking. I came from an alpine skiing background, so instead of having to hike down, you get to ski down. And it really, you can do it anywhere. There's snow, and it's probably one of the best ways to spend time outdoors.
So you hike up on your skis.
Yep, skis on. You keep the skis on, and you have these things called skins, which you put on the bottom of your skis, and they enable you to just, if you think of classic cross-country skiing, go right up the snow. They're nice and grippy. And then when you get to the top where you're done, where you're ready to transition to ski back down, you just peel them off, put them in your backpack, and you can ski.
And I want to let everybody know that you sent our team a text last night saying, still out here. I mean, what is it that keeps you going out, even at night, even before you have to come on a radio show the next day?
It's all about getting out when you can get out, and that might be normal hours, you know, sunlight hours, or it could be at the, you know, under the moon. It really just depends on your schedule and your motivation. So there's nothing better than, in my opinion, being out by myself, 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, just, you know, getting in that last bit of exercise before calling it a day.
Well, and I want to let everybody know, our producer Jessica Hunt put up some videos, photos, great explainers on our website, nhpr.org/exchange, including a video of you, Andrew, skiing down Mount Adams, I think it is. So folks should check that out. How about you, Tyler? What's the appeal?
Well, it's a great question. I think a lot of backcountry skiers would respond and saying, not only to add what Andrew said, but the allure of being out in the mountains and skiing a fresh, untracked line of either powder or corn snow. You know, it's being in the solitude of enjoying your own exercise and being out in the mountains, and you know, that's really what it comes down to. It's that fresh snow, that untouched. You're the first one there. It's really, it's a great feeling. And as a skier, you know, that's where those are the best, the ultimate conditions. And so chasing that, everyone's always chasing that. Where's the fresh snow? And so to me, that's what it all kind of dials back to.
And is backcountry skiing, Tyler, basically the same as what people call telemark skiing? Is it the same thing or is it different?
Well, there's certainly similarities. Telemark skiing is really more of the birth of backcountry skiing, and that's where your heel is unlocked. So you're free-heeled, as they say.
I see.
And so you, as alpine touring, your heel is free, and you get to the top, and as Andrew mentioned, you have skins on, you rip the skins off, and then you lock the heel down so you're as if you just got off the chairlift at a resort. So you're in that, you know, alpine setup, whereas telemark skiers, their heel stays free and they ski down, and it's telemark skiing is beautiful. It's really quite an art form. A real quality tele skier is something to watch. So there are two different forms really of getting down. And then you also have split boarding, which is snowboarding. But the way those folks access or ascend is with a split board, with a snowboard that's literally cut in half. And we get to the, so it's like two skis. You have the skin, so you act like a skier, and then you get to the top, and you hook the board back together, and it's a snowboard again. And you buckle in and ride down.
Snowboarding so, down the really presidentials, good. Tyler.
That's it, yep.
Well, okay, so... So, and I've hiked those mountains, and they're big, and there are a lot of rocks, and there's a lot of scrub, and there's a lot of trees. And, you know, how do you work your way around it, Andrew, without killing yourself?
Patience, a little patience. We're on the East Coast. It's not always powder, and
right.
the conditions are variable.
I see.
Think that's a polite way of putting it. And those days when you just want to get out, you have to deal with what you have. And skiing in the backcountry, one thing that we as skiers, Tyler and I both do, is we try to mitigate risks. And with rocks and cliffs and fallen trees and all the other obstacles you're going to encounter, you have to tone it down a bit. You have to ski a little slower, make more turns, be aware of what you're skiing down. And so, you know, that's skiing a little more cautiously, and that will allow you to avoid all those hazards as
How
best
do you
as
avoid
possible.
Bouncing off a boulder. I mean, some of those mountains are just boulder fields.
Well, you hopefully find a better route down.
Yeah.
And when we go and we analyze the routes we're going to ski, we try to get eyes on them first so we know, hey, maybe we won't, that's not ready to be skied, or this doesn't feel right. And that can be because of avalanche danger or just because of hard conditions or exposure to rocks. We call that, you know, sometimes slide for life when it's so firm and icy that if you did fall, you're going to go all the way down. And, you know, we all have family back home and friends and stuff. So we have to take that into consideration in the choices we make in the backcountry.
Talk about that as well, Tyler. Some people say, you know, ski the ice instead of ski the east because our snow conditions are notoriously difficult. How do you make your way down with all the ice and boulders and trees and everything else?
Well, there's a few things. You know, number one is that to Andrew, what Andrew mentioned, it's really, you know, the type of skiing we're doing is calculated skiing. You know, we're making informed decisions. We're continuously educating ourselves and observing what's happening around us. What are the snow conditions? What are the features? What are the terrain traps? You know, it's really important to observe and understand your environment. The other thing is, you know, experience goes a long way. When you're in a lot of that high consequence terrain, again, you're making good quality decisions. You're understanding where you are, how to get down. And, you know, a lot of times the issues that you'll find, you know, certainly accidents happen, right? That's just, I mean, you can, that happens driving your car. So, you know, if we look at everything has a point of relativity here, but, you know, experience goes a long way and just understanding really where your whereabouts and having wherewithal, because the mountains are bigger than you, and having that respect is really important.
That's a really good way to put it. The mountains are bigger than you. In these cases, a lot bigger than you. By the way, we're talking about backcountry skiing, this segment on The Exchange. A little bit later, we'll turn to ice climbing. With a nod to the Winter Olympics, we're looking at winter sports here in New Hampshire. Especially, we're interested in this rise in backcountry skiing, where, as our guests are telling us, you climb all the way up the mountain, and then you ski back down. Maybe you only get one run in, but it's pretty awesome. You can join us with your questions and comments. exchange@nhpr.org is the email. exchange@nhpr.org. Or give us a call, 1-800 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Andrew Drummond is here. He runs Ski the Whites. He also runs events and a retail shop at the Black Mountain Ski Area in Jackson. Tyler Ray's on the phone. He's the Granite Chief of the Granite Backcountry Alliance. And Tyler, another question for you. What's the history of backcountry skiing? Even though it's rising in popularity, I've heard that it's not really new.
Well, it's interesting. It's a great question because it's often a forgotten point about skiing. And so-called backcountry skiing, what we call it in modern-day times, is really that's the origins of skiing in and of itself. And in North Conway, which is the headquarters of Granite Backcountry Alliance, it's like the epicenter of Northeast backcountry skiing. It's where it all began back in the 1930s. And during that time, you had a huge rush, a surge into the ski world. It came over from Europe and just popped up everywhere from, the Dartmouth and Harvard skiers up in Tuckerman Ravine to the ski trains coming into the North Country. And you also had the government playing a part. The FDR program created the Civilian Conservation Corps, and they've cut over 60 ski trails in New Hampshire in the 1930s. Which is an amazing fact when you think about it. There are ski clubs all over the state, and this is before chairless, mind you. And what happened is you'd have these communities that would apply to the CCC, their ski clubs, and they're in small towns, and they would apply to the CCC. The CCC would come to town and cut the ski trail and move on to the next town, and then this ski trail would be sort of the basis of wintertime recreation in that town. And over the years, once the chairless came into play, these trails, many of which became abandoned, some of them became absorbed and turned into resorts. But it's this rich history. You have like I mentioned, the Ivy League schools, the European influence, and it's really how it all began, hiking up to ski down.
So a long way before chairlifts and groom trails and, lights on the trails at night and so forth, people were, chomping up the mountain and then skiing back down 100 years ago.
Yeah, it was an amazing popularity swing into the sport, and that's what provided for that boom. And a lot of what we're doing at Granite Backcountry Alliance is trying to take that history and revive it. Meaning, a lot of these trails, this is like a starting point for what we're trying to do with creating glade skiing, is find out where these trails are, look at the current landowners, and attempt to revive history, but not just recut the trail, do so in a modern way, meaning glade skiing, below tree line. Andrew and I were talking about earlier, skiing down Tuckerman Ravine and whatnot. That's more of a high alpine experience. Granite Backcountry Alliance is really focused on developing a below tree line network of ski trails, which we really don't have. And the glades, just so everyone understands what glade skiing means, it's really what we do is we thin out the trees, the canopy stays in place, low impact, sustainable forestry methods, and you're skiing and navigating through the trees. You see glades at many resorts, but what we're creating are these, you could call them backcountry resorts, where there's zones that we identify and cut a series of different ski glades.
So, Tyler, you guys are trying to find these old Civilian Conservation Corps trails built during the Great Depression and revive them.
That's part of it. That's part of what we're doing. It's a great starting point. It's there's historical precedent for skiing in that area. Oftentimes there's a reason why people chose those locations, whether it related to elevation, aspect, what have you. But it's a really cool thing to kind of chase history and seek to revive it.
Andrew, when did you first start getting involved in this? You said that you, started skiing just like most people on the chairlift and heading down.
I'm relatively new to it. If you look at the big picture, I picked it up in 2011. My brother was living in Anchorage, Alaska. Went out to visit him, and I had heard about the sport. I was dead set on learning it. Went out, had this incredible experience where I combined a hut trip with heli skiing with...
Wait, heli skiing?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, you have to tell me what that is.
Taking a helicopter up.
That's what I thought.
Some people call that cheating, but it's one of those bucket list items that I think every alpine skier dreams of, and it just incorporated everything together. And I loved the challenge of being human powered, using my own two feet to get into these remote areas to ski that powder that Tyler was talking about, steep open terrain, and I was hooked ever since.
Why do you think this is growing more popular? And we'll talk about this a little bit later. I mean, even the regular, highly manicured ski areas are trying to put some more of this authentic experience in.
It's this perfect storm we're getting of the gear is getting light and sturdy and reliable and easy to use. So this used to be clunky, weird, just this weird gear that it was difficult to use, and it probably turned people off to it, whereas maybe it was only specifically used with teleskis or some other gear that was just it took a lot of effort to get up the hill. But now everything's light and fast, and the technology's improving, and every ski manufacturer makes it so the gear's now becoming more and more accessible, more prevalent. You see it at all the Alpine stores. Every store has some sort of Alpine touring compatible gear. And then you combine that with the boom of people getting into these endurance sports, finding their inner endurance little animal in there that gets them going, and they get, you know, whether you're a marathon runner, triathlete, you could be a Nordic skier, just a hiker, but these are all people that love to go, go, go. And now this uphilling that you can do at the resort or you can do in the backcountry is just another form of exercise and enjoyment.
Do you think the Winter Olympics kind of lights that flame? I hate to, that's a really bad pun, but do you think the Winter Olympics gets people more excited about getting out in winter, maybe getting a little extreme, gets people more enthusiastic about that?
I'd hope so. I mean, watching all these athletes perform and perform their discipline at the highest level possible is really inspiring. And there's a ton of competitions and events in the Northeast that you can test yourself and improve. And you don't have to be going for the gold medal, but you can start setting goals for yourself. And goals, to me, is really just all about being motivated. And that sometimes just means getting off the couch, getting outside, and being in the mountains or just going to your local ski resort.
What do you think, Tyler? How much do the Winter Olympics sort of amp up people's desire to get outside and maybe go for something a little more on the edge?
Oh, there's no doubt about it that, it's inspiring and stokes the fire, so to speak, using your pun. It's just fun to watch. And, you know, what we're seeing in the backcountry skiing community is what we kind of see in a broader perspective with the Olympics, which is that sense of community, you know, with the outdoor enthusiasts and rallying behind sport. You know, it's a really inspiring thing. And it definitely motivates me. And, you know, even watching the Olympics with my kids or whatever, seeing odd sports, anything, just people are enjoying the outdoors, and that's awesome.
You know, Andrew, there's a renewed push by the U.S. Telemark Ski Association. And you mentioned earlier backcountry skiing isn't exactly Telemark, but similar. To have Telemark skiing added to the list of Winter Olympics, how do you feel about this?
I think any sport that you can get into the Olympics, any winter alpine sport, skiing with skis on, is incredible. I know that ski mountaineering was in consideration, or it is, and it's a process where you incorporate all this technical abilities of taking off your skis, hiking, crampons, being roped in, and just going up and down. These people are doing upwards of 2,000 meters in a race, in a competition, and they're doing it multi-day in stages, and it's really popular over in Europe. And over here, we're getting into it. We're embracing it. It's bigger, I think, out west, but on the Northeast, we have a few different race series, and it's the stepping stone. You know, if it's popular worldwide, then hopefully we can see this in the Olympics.
So you would like to see it in the Olympics? Because sometimes people are like, not so sure I really want the U.S. Olympic Committee messing with my sport.
Yeah, I think everyone wants to see their sport in the Olympics if it's a competitive sport and it's appropriate and the level of talent's there, then, you know, I think I'm all for it.
All right, coming up, we will hear from our listeners, and I have a lot more questions for you guys, including how you're working with the White Mountains here in New Hampshire, maybe some lessons from the Green Mountains in Vermont, about accommodating this growing group of backcountry skiers. And we'll start taking your calls, so join us at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. More in a moment. This is Laura Kanoy. Join me for Governor Sununu's State of the State Address as he takes stock of his past year in office and looks ahead. I'll be in the studio with NHPR reporters and analysts, and we'll have lawmaker reaction from both sides of the aisle. State of the State coverage begins today at 10 a.m. on NHPR and NHPR.org. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, inspired by the Winter Olympics, in a few minutes, we'll talk to a North Country guide about climbing up cliffs of ice. But first, more on backcountry skiing, where, as our guests are telling us, you hike up the mountain on your skis and then you ski back down. Join us with your comments and questions. And as we're learning some of the history around this, send email to exchange@nhpr.org. exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter. It's NHPR Exchange. Or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Also, be sure to check out our website today for lots of great photos, videos, information. That's nhpr.org/exchange, including a video of one of our guests skiing down Mount Adams recently. That's Andrew Drummond. He runs Ski the Whites. Also with us is Tyler Ray, Granite Chief of the Granite Backcountry Alliance. That's a group that promotes greater access and development for backcountry skiing. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And guys, let's go to the phones. And Grace is joining us from Plymouth. Hi, Grace. Go ahead. You're in the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've actually been backcountry skiing since the late 80s. And I just wanted to clarify that I know, Laura, you said something about telemark is not the same thing as backcountry. But I think what your guests are trying to explain is that in the backcountry, you can do three methods of getting down the mountain or down the trails, and that is telemark or alpine, which is fixed heel, or snowboarding. So there are just three different ways you can backcountry ski.
Lots of options. So what do you prefer, Grace, or does it really matter?
I'm actually a telemark skier.
Yeah.
And I took up telemark in 1988. So that's my preferred method.
And I
absolutely love backcountry skiing in New England. It's really fantastic.
Have you done this in the presidentials yet?
Yes.
On your telemark skis?
Yes.
Okay. And how did that go for you? Those are some big, rough mountains.
Right. Well, as your hosts describe, the conditions are different, and it depends upon the day, depends upon the aspect, and it depends upon the terrain that you're skiing. So, I mean, it goes in different ways. It's always really fun, but you have to be prepared, and you have to have an eye on what you're doing and be really cautious and understand that when you go up into the mountains by yourself or with friends and you're backcountry skiing, you can't, you know, rely on ski patrol folks to rescue you. So you have to make really good decisions in skiing different conditions and different terrain.
Well, Grace, thank you so much for the call. Really appreciate it.
All right.
Bye-bye.
And thanks to the guys for moving forward with these projects.
Again, the number for you to join us like Grace did, 1-800-892-6477. Or send us an email as we look at backcountry skiing and the growth here in the Granite State. The email is exchange@nhpr.org. Guys, here's an email from Andy that just came in who says, sadly, recent natural snowfall levels drives uphill side country traffic to lift areas. Some areas have embraced this. Others kick you off. Discuss, Andy says. And thanks, Andy, because I did want to talk about this. So, Tyler, you first. How are those, what we could now call traditional ski areas, you know, with the lifts and the grooming and the snowmaking, how are those areas embracing backcountry skiing or, as Andy suggests, not embracing it? Go ahead, Tyler. I want to hear from you too, Andrew, but go ahead, Tyler.
Yeah, there's no doubt there's a varying degree of acceptance, almost similar to what you saw when snowboarding came in the late 80s. You know, it's the surge. It's the fastest growing segment of the ski industry. So it's something that can't necessarily be denied. It's certainly there. It exists. Although that said, it's still certainly a subcategory. You have certain mountains, you know, that have accepted it, embraced it, and really brought it into the fold. Like where Andrew is at Black Mountain in New Hampshire, where he operates Ski the Whites. It's that has changed. This is his first year there, and that mountain, I can tell you, the culture has almost changed overnight. It's a very accepting environment, and it's really cool to see, folks being outside in different methods. There's other mountains that continue to, reject it. And but I think what you're generally seeing on average, if you want to look at the median here, is a general willingness to accept it. And each mountain has created an uphill policy. Almost all mountains have them now. I would say a large majority have an uphill policy. It's just something that they have to deal with. Folks are, getting on the terrain, on off hours and during operating hours. And it's certainly been an issue for mountains to deal with. There's not the obvious elements of liability and risk for having guests, non-paying guests, on your mountain that you have invested substantial amounts in, whether it be grooming, snowmaking, et cetera. So they've had to grapple with these issues, and a lot of it is insurance-based, but interestingly, many have taken different approaches. And so
an uphill policy, Tyler, would involve how you are allowed to use the mountain, climbing uphill on those skis with skins, and also what the ski area is liable for if you, crash into something.
Yeah, I mean, a typical uphill policy will, discuss, some of the material things about use, time of use, where you can use the mountain, what trails, route selection, safety, and, sort of at your own risk, disclaimer language. So that would be like a typical uphill policy. And some, again, every resort is different in how they've embraced it. Some allow it off hours, some don't. Some allow it on hours, some don't. So there's a variety of responses.
Well, Andrew, I'd love to hear from you, too, on this, because, again, you work on this at the Black Mountain Ski Area, and I'm fascinated to hear Tyler say that this backcountry skiing, uphill and downhill, is the fastest-growing area of the ski industry. So the ski areas, Tyler's saying, probably shouldn't ignore it. Credit to Dave Brooks, by the way, at the Concord Monitor for this information. Pat's Peak, you can skin for free, so put your skins on and go up. Cannon Mountain sells a lower-cost skinning ticket, where you can skin your way up. Crotchet Mountain, Dave Brooks tells us, has hosted up and down hill races, so run up and then ski down. How about you at Black Mountain, Andrew? What are you doing there in terms of an uphill policy and encouraging this fast-growing area of skiing?
I think Black Mountain is the perfect example of uphilling in the trajectory throughout ski resorts. They created a policy that basically pulled from a bunch of different mountains, all the things we liked. I got to help shape that and put that into place. But on a winter like we've had, or the past few winters, when we get rain or the lack of snow, this is a little safe haven to go and get some exercise and prepare yourself for when you go back into the backcountry. Because, at the resort, you're not technically backcountry skiing, you're uphilling. And man-made snow is a lot more durable than Mother Nature's snow. So even with all the rain we've had, all this man-made snow that costs money, and they groom it, and we're using it. So to pay for an uphill ticket or $10, $9 to go use that snow in their facilities, it's really not that big of an expense. And it's really critical, I think, in my opinion, to keep strong and keep using your gear so that when you do get out into the backcountry, you're ready and you're prepared for it. And the resorts that, most resorts will have, like Tyler said, an uphill policy. And what we're doing at Black Mountain is we're trying to really embrace the backcountry culture so that people can can try it without all these external variables. You've got this controlled environment. You're not worried about the avalanche danger. You're not worried about the extreme weather at Mount Washington that you'd find, or the hazards like the rocks and trees we talked about. You can just focus on learning how to use this new gear. And it's a lot of gear. Backcountry gear is now very, there's a lot of variation in bindings and skis. Even poles, helmets, goggles are all focused for backcountry specific use. And having the opportunity to get people break down this equipment barrier at my store, I'm able to rent out equipment and they can try it out. And then if they like it, they can go get a guide, go in and take their skiing to the next level of backcountry skiing.
So if you're worried about it, you can try it at a ski area. It's a little bit more of a safe environment, see what you think, and then go out. It's almost like learning how to rock climb at a climbing wall and then going out to the cliffs for real.
Absolutely. I think that's critical for any sport that costs a lot of money, too. You don't just want to be buying the stuff online. You want to go to your local shop. And there's several shops in Vermont, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Maine, where you can all go in and try boots on, see the gear, talk to experts, and then make an educated decision on the gear you're going to get, what's going to be best suited for what you really want to do. Because some people want to go light and fast, and other people want to focus more on the downhill experience.
Well, and as Andy, our emailer, points out, natural snowfall is a little less predictable these days. So you've got the ski area while you're waiting for that to improve. Andy, thank you so much for the email. Back to the phones, and Sean joins us from Littleton. Hi, Sean. Thanks for calling in. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura. Yeah, I just want to make a comment. I learned to backcountry ski in Utah, lived out there for a number of years, and then moved back to New England. And just the contrast between the options and the availability for backcountry skiing out west versus New England. Out west, you know, the trees are spaced further apart. There's a lot more, you know, open terrain versus here. They're, you know, pretty limited to chutes and stream channels and gullies and, you know, not so much, there's not a lot of natural bladed terrain. So, as you know, my primary comment is that there's a real need in New England to maintain and actually create backcountry skiing terrain and opportunities, especially below tree line like these guys are talking about. And, you know, most of our terrain, potential terrain is on the White Mountain Forest, you know, that's controlled by the federal government. And so that presents challenges, which I think these guys will probably talk about in terms of actually developing that terrain. But with the growing popularity of the sport, I think there really needs to be, you know, a concerted effort to create that terrain to meet that demand.
Well, Sean, I'm so glad you called because Tyler did want to talk to you about this. From what I understand, the Granite Backcountry Alliance is working with the White Mountain National Forest to promote backcountry skiing. Tell us sort of what that emphasis is all about and, you know, where you may run into concerns from the White Mountain National Forest folks.
Well, we've had a, we'll start off by saying we've had a wonderful relationship with the National Forest. We approached them about a year and a half ago, and there's no doubt as to what Sean just had mentioned, this, you know, surge in the sport, and, you know, we really have a supply issue. You know, it's a scarcity issue, actually. The demand is so high, and, you know, the Forest Service recognizes that. You know, currently there are no approved or sanctioned glade areas or trails in the National Forest. There are some old historic ski trails cut back in the 30s, which we talked about earlier, but this new glade thing is new to them, but they recognize, credit to them, they have recognized this demand. And, you know, the difference between now and years past is that the Forest Service, among other land managers or owners, are now a bit more willing to work with partners like Granite Backcountry Alliance, you know, advocacy groups. And frankly, it's not uncommon to have, you know, backcountry skiers on the other side of the table now. There's a you know, a full-scale desire to see these developed, and so that all interest groups, including backcountry skiing as well as many other types of sports, are recognized in the National Forest. So our relationship with the National Forest has been great. You know, there's certainly been challenges in terms of implementation of the concepts that we're talking about. The National Forest operates on a forestry plan, and backcountry skiing is not necessarily it's absent from that. And so we're kind of starting from scratch and working with the Forest Service and to create these new opportunities. Because as Sean said, that's really what the need is. You know, what we have in New England is what I always call a tree density problem, which really means, you know, it's hard to find places to ski. You know, and a lot of that's due to the timber boom of the early 1900s. Everything grew back, you know, so quickly, and at the same time, the forests just haven't matured after being completely obliterated by logging. So that's what we're up against, and that's what we're doing. We're looking to create new lands and places to ski, and the White Mountain National Forest, no doubt, is the coveted areas, the coveted land. That's where they have the best elevation aspect and so forth. So good progress so far. They've been great to work with, so that's a real plus.
Speaking of backcountry skiing in the Whites, and not to throw a wet blanket on this for just a minute, but one of our most popular shows last year was about danger in the White Mountains, especially in winter. The weather, as you guys know, is extremely unpredictable in the Whites. And I wonder, Andrew, you first, how do the rescuers at New Hampshire Fish and Game and all the great volunteer groups in the North Country, in the White Mountains, feel about the expansion of backcountry skiing? Are they worried they're going to have to run out there more if more people start doing this?
Yeah, it's definitely a concern. I think anyone that's going to put themselves out in the mountains, doesn't matter what time of year, what the weather is, there's always a concern. Are they prepared enough? Do they know what they're getting into? Are they capable? And with the boom in backcountry skiers and wanting to go find fresh tracks, they're branching out further and further. I'm guilty of that as well. I'm going out some of my tours. I'm going out 12 hours just to go find a spot to ski a remote location. I might be by myself. And the risks are there. It's very inherent. And so it's from the rescuer's perspective, yeah, it's a concern. And especially if you start throwing in avalanche danger, which we know we have the Mount Washington Avalanche Center, which you can check every morning to see if, you know, that's only one concern. Avalanche danger isn't a major thing for, I would say, the majority of my backcountry tours. I know if it's recently snowed, I'm probably not going out. If it's really windy, I'm probably not going to go out as well. I'm going to find these little secluded zones, and some of those are far out there. They're going to take half a day just to get to. And I think that's the risk we're going to see is, you know, hopefully people are being educated in their trip planning and their preparedness to get out there. But anything can happen. We were talking about you need these wake-up calls to make you realize that you are vulnerable. And, you know, we just had a friend's friend just, you know, broke her leg out in some glades this weekend. And that took 4 hours at least to get her out.
Wow.
So the reality is that any sport, you know, the risk is there. And we try to minimize that. But, yeah, you're out there in these remote places. It's bound to happen.
What do you think about this, Tyler, too? Again, as more people jump in, you said this is the fastest growing area of the ski industry. That might mean more people in the backcountry who need to be rescued, and Fish and Game folks tell us they're pretty strapped when it comes to rescue.
Yeah, well, you know, the way I look at this is a couple of ways. One is that, you know, ultimately backcountry skiing is no different than any other sport. Mountain biking, hiking, trail running, kayaking. I mean, there's inherent risk involved in all of these sports. What needs to happen is the users and their communities need to be cultivating an environment that is supportive of educating the users and, you know, putting a focus on safety. We, moving over towards Fish and Game, we've met with them, we spoke with them. We actually have the president of Mountain Rescue Service, which is a volunteer organization, on our board, Steve Dupuy, who's also a mountain guide. And we've been working through those issues. Fish and Game is, I think, perceives it, as I sort of mentioned at the outset here, that, you know, this is, sure, there's a new use that's happening, but it's really not. It's been around for a long time. You know, the high alpine people have been skiing that for, you know, a long time, as we've discussed. So what we're really doing is expanding some terrain. Sure, we're creating some, encouraging more people to get out and enjoy public lands, and I don't see that as a bad thing. You know, as I said, the safety aspect and teaching folks to make the right decisions, have the right things in your backpack, in your kit, you know, the tools for survival. That's what it is. You know, this is what we're doing. And so, sure, it's gone a little mainstream, and people get sometimes a little soft when they think about it, but, you know, you got to be prepared. You got to be accountable and responsible. And you can't just go run off, you know, up the mountain, you know, skiing in your jeans. You know,
skiing in your jeans. Oh, my gosh, in the whites. That does not sound advisable. Bunch more emails I'd love to share with you guys. Folks asking questions, making some more points. So hold on after a short break, and we'll hear from some more of our listeners. Somebody wants to know, for example, if backcountry skiing organizations are working with the New Hampshire Bureau of Trails, so we'll tackle that. Somebody else wants to talk about a great example in Vermont that they think New Hampshire should emulate. So all that's coming up. Keep it right here. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
In the late 80s, I had a BMW, and it was vintage when I got it.
First car I ever had was a 1974 Dodge Dart.
A Chevy Celebrity, two-door.
A 1976 Chevy van.
I did love it, yes.
It was called the Gan Van.
Imagine turning the car you once loved into the NHPR programs you now value. We'll even send you a $50 gift card as our thanks. Donate your car or truck at nhpr.org/car donation.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. We'd love your input before Thursday's show. As the governor delivers his State of the State address, we want to know what's the state of your city or town. How would you assess it? Leave us a voicemail before the show. Go to our website for more information on that, nhpr.org/exchange. Be sure to check out the website today, too. Producer Jessica Hunt put up some great photos, videos, and explainers of what we're talking about. Winter sports here in New Hampshire, especially the dramatic rise in backcountry skiing. And then a little bit later, we're going to talk about ice climbing. We'd love to hear from you. Lots of questions and comments are coming in. Email is exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Andrew Drummond, Tyler Ray, right back to our listeners. Sky is calling in from Warren. Hi, Sky. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yes. Hi. Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And thanks for doing this show. This is great. I'm a 30-year veteran of the alpine ski industry. I'm a ski instructor in the last 10 years spent at the Dartmouth Skiway, which Dartmouth has a huge impact on the history of alpine skiing here in the United States, which I'm just finding out about. And these gentlemen have been talking about revisiting old ski trails that were carved by the CCC, et cetera, which, guys, I love that. That's awesome. And one of the first sanctioned downhill races in the United States was right here in Warren, New Hampshire, on Mount Moosilauk, back, you know, before Rudolf Lettner discovered metal edges for skis in 1937. These guys were walking up these hills, skiing down a downhill race where you actually had to fall to make the turn. There's old footage of it. And they're discovering these old trails, and I'm wondering, have you looked at some of these old downhill routes on Mount Moosilauk over here?
Wow. Sky, thank you so much for the call. Tyler, that one's for you, I think.
Yeah, it is. I'll take that. It's a great question. And I first want to say, you know, one of our Grand Backcountry Alliance's big priorities of 2018 is getting into the Western Whites. You know, this past year we have two pending projects with the National Forest, but those are in the Saco District, more in the Eastern Whites. So the short answer is yes, we're definitely looking over there. We have several identified spots. We're in conversations with the Forest Service, and you know, it's what people have to understand is that, you know, what we're dealing with is property rights, land managers, duties and obligations, process, and so forth. It's not an overnight thing. You know, I get emails quite often from folks that are like, hey, I've got a team of a crew of that, and we're ready to go cut. You know, let's can we do this trail over in this location? And it's like, well, you know, hit the brakes for a minute. Yeah, we can, hopefully, but let's work. We have to work through the process, and that's really working with the land manager and understanding how they want to steward their property. And the National Forest is, you know, no different than some other governmental organizations in which there is a process and there is an environmental review, national rules and regulations that need to be followed. So it is a slower process. Patience is required, but Moosilauk for sure has tons of nice terrain and no doubt a target of ours.
Well, and here's another email that came in from Jeff in Concord about Vermont and what they're doing there. Jeff says, I want to highlight Mount Ascutney as a model for a successful community-driven recreational area. I recently visited, Jeff says, for some backcountry skiing, and despite frigid temperatures on this particular day, I found many other outdoor enthusiasts enjoying the bright sunshine, the snowy slopes. Jeff says, from my limited understanding, the community took over when the ski resort closed a few years ago, and it is now a year-round park, a true outdoor destination, and an economic driver for the surrounding area. Jeff says, this is a model that should be repeated more. Does Vermont provide a model, Andrew, for New Hampshire?
They do in many aspects. Originally, well, first off, what's happening over at Ascutney is incredible. If we could all have a little mini Ascutney in our backyard, that would be something really special, because it is a geographical feature that the community can get behind, and it's not just wintertime, it's summer, it's spring, it's fall, and it's getting people outdoors. And of course, for backcountry skiing, to make use of old trails and terrain and cut glades and really redesign it the way the backcountry community wants to is important. You can put, you know, I think they have a rope tow or something else there, but it's, you know, that's just one aspect of it. And then you start looking at what else Vermont's doing, and they have Rasta, and their Vermont Backcountry Alliance over
Wait,
there.
Wait, what's RASTA?
RASTA, the Rochester Area Sports, was it Trails Association? I always mix it up. Yeah, and they were actually the pioneers for the East Coast in getting approval to put glades in the Green Mountains and federally managed lands, so or state managed lands, and they have had tremendous success and really positive feedback. They're able to cut, I think, what do they claim, like 20,000 vertical feet of glade terrain, and it's always expanding and growing, and they provide this backcountry experience that's managed, but it's still complete wilderness out there. And our friends over there, we meet up with mid-season, pre-season, end of season, and it's all about joining forces to make sure that everyone's benefiting from, the backcountry community and the resources.
Well, here's another question from someone who wants to know about working with the Bureau of Trails. Tim says, what relationship, if any, does backcountry skiing have with the New Hampshire Bureau of Trails? So maybe you first, Tyler, you talked about how the backcountry, your group, the Granite Backcountry Alliance, has been working with the White Mountain National Forest. So that's at the federal level, and there's that whole process of rules and regs and federal oversight and so forth. What about the New Hampshire Bureau of Trails, Tyler?
Yeah, there's no doubt we've been working with the state of New Hampshire, not just at the Bureau of Trails, but in a variety of different divisions and departments. As I mentioned earlier, there's definitely process involved. The State Lands Committee, National Heritage Bureau. The list kind of goes on, and you need to check the box on all the different items. In each case, federal, state, what have you, there's usually, one point person that we work with, and they help us, go through the checklist. And
have you found them, Tyler, to be interested in this as an economic driver, them being the New Hampshire Bureau of Trails? Because they have worked a lot on ATV trails, for example. That's been a real focus for the New Hampshire Bureau. So have you said, about us?
Yeah, there's definitely interest there. And we have a project that's under review right now. But I will say first that, specifically the Bureau of Trails, I think there needs to be a decision, as to what defines trails. And that's sort of become somewhat of an issue because we're creating these zones or these dispersed areas. And in fact, the state may call them dispersed trails. So there's a different definition in terms of how grant funding goes and so forth. So it's a little up in the air. But that said, New Hampshire's definitely interested, no doubt. We have a project that is an exciting project, and it goes back to the Ascutney model, which I'm very excited about talking about because it's a big component of GBA. GBA's really our primary strategy, as I mentioned earlier, is getting into the White Mountain National Forest. But the underlying strategy, it's really important to diversifying what we're offering our user base. And that is honing in on the model of the CCC of the 1930s. I mentioned earlier at the outset of the
show. That history from the Civilian Conservation Corps, Great Depression. Let's create work for folks.
Yeah, the ski clubs would have the CCC come to town and, would create this economic driver and opportunity for wintertime recreation. So that's what we're looking at doing on the municipal and state level, is working with individual, working with smaller groups, localizing our efforts, working with the boots on the ground, the locals that will probably be skiing it primarily. And that's why I say to anyone listening, if you have some terrain in your backyard and you want to seek glading, reach out to us. Let us know. We can help. This is what we're doing. Granite Backcountry bounces around to these different municipalities or state locations and works with the various groups or individuals to develop a plan and a strategy. And then if we can get through all of the red tape, that's when we bring in the volunteers and we literally cut the glades.
So, Tyler, just like the CCC of old, the Civilian Conservation Corps, you're saying today's backcountry skiing expansion is an economic driver.
Yeah, and no doubt. Oh, absolutely. Right. And I think outdoor recreation nationally is the fourth biggest industry. It's giant. It is giant, but often neglected due to the fact that there's a difficulty in quantifying what sort of impact it's having on the economy. You have folks driving up from Boston at 3 a.m, go to the trailhead, they go do their skiing, they get back in the car, they hit gas station, a restaurant, maybe they spend the night in a hotel, maybe they go back to Boston, but would never know they were there. How do you quantify that? So there's a difficulty in recognition, but what I think you're going to see and nationally, and this is trending, is just the outdoor movement. And this is, a lot of it's led by, you know, apparel groups that are starting to step up. And
sure, they want people to buy their stuff and get out there and wear it.
The world, the Cliff Bars of the world, and they're really encouraging this type of use. But at any rate, our strategy is to focus on these localized areas, and we found that really effective, and people have been very receptive to that, and you know, we're helping build communities, you know, wintertime recreational opportunities in their community.
Tyler and Andrew, I'm going to wrap you up there. I really appreciate you guys coming in, educating me for sure and our listeners on the growth of backcountry skiing. Tyler, thank you very much for your time.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you.
That's Tyler Ray. He's the Granite Chief of the Granite Backcountry Alliance. And Andrew Drummond, it was really nice to meet you. Thank
you
so much for being here. That's Andrew Drummond. He runs Ski the Whites and also events in a retail shop at the Black Mountain Ski Area in Jackson. As we transition briefly to the topic of ice climbing and its popularity, which is huge in the Granite State, I want to share just a couple other emails from our listeners on backcountry skiing. Marilyn says, I'm a longtime skier and snowboarder and hiker who took up Nordic a few years back, which has evolved into backcountry telemark. Backcountry allows my husband and I to explore some of the longstanding backcountry trails your guests are talking about. And then here's this email from Mike, who says, there's nothing like the feeling of a powder day when you earn your turns. The skin up is completely enjoyable. Getting to the summit, pulling off your skins, and getting ready for the descent as the sun shines through the lightly falling snow. Mike says, then the quiet of perfect turns is awesome. Mike, thank you so much for that email. And to everybody else who emailed in today, I'm sorry we couldn't get to all of you. But I do want to turn to another winter sport that is also very popular in the Granite State and has been for a long time. Brad White is with us to talk about ice climbing. He's a longtime climber and guide from the Mount Washington Valley. He's co-owner and director of the International Mountain Climbing School in North Conway. And Brad White, really nice to have you. Thank you for being with us.
You're welcome. I am here.
Well, I was surprised to read just this morning, Brad, that the International Ice Climbing and Mountaineering Federation has been trying to get ice climbing recognized as an Olympic sport. Now, how do you feel about that?
You know, they've tried it in the past, and they've also done it with competition rock climbing and stuff like that. And ice climbing certainly is an exciting sport to do. I'm not certain if it's an exciting sport to watch at times, but it is a very interesting interesting twist on a very old theme. You know, ice climbing with the new modern tools has changed dramatically. And every single year we have huge leaps and bounds in equipment and clothing and stuff that makes it more and more accessible to the average person.
So I watched a couple of videos of people competing. There's sort of a World Cup of ice climbing. Who knew? And I always thought of ice climbing, Brad, as something you would sort of carefully and painstakingly do, but not in these competitions. People are just going chunk, 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 chunk up these giant walls of ice.
Yeah, they have a different types of competitions and stuff like that. In fact, with ice climbing, since you're holding on to ice tools, which have handles and stuff like that, there's a, with real ice, natural ice, there's a limit to what you can almost get to with the difficulty because you are holding on to handles and, you know, either the kind of the tool either sticks or it doesn't sort of thing. So what they've done in a lot of ice climbing competitions is they've added what they call a mixed element. And what they mean by mixed is they throw in either some actual rock climbing with ice tools, or they have severely overhanging walls that they put artificial holds on that you can actually hook the ice tools onto. And this way they can move up natural ice for a given length, whatever they decide, and then switch over and go out these huge overhanging walls where they're hooking, using the ice tools as steel fingers. It's it really ups the ante if you're looking for, you know, high-end competition and stuff. So they do high-end competitions and they do speed climbing. And speed climbing, of course, can use more natural ice and more real ice, and you don't have to go to the artificial holes to make it more difficult.
Well, Brad, I want to bring our listeners into the conversation as well. They've been jumping in a lot on this conversation we had earlier about backcountry skiing and also want to jump in on ice climbing. So let's go to Peter in Plainfield. And Peter, thanks for waiting. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, hello. Thank you.
Sure. Go ahead, Peter.
Yeah, I just wanted to talk a little more. I mean, Brad brought up all the modern tools and stuff like that, but I wanted to kind of go back to the traditional part of ice climbing, you know, all the classic climbs in New Hampshire, like the Pinnacle on Huntington Ravine up on Mount Washington, the Black Dyke and Omega on Cannon Cliff. You know, that's really where it all started. But I also wanted to point out that, you know, although New Hampshire is some of the best ice in the country, right across the river in Vermont, Lake Willoughby has some of the best ice in the world. It's one of the highest concentrations of long, hard ice climbs, with climbs like Last Gentleman, Promenade, Called on Account of Rain. So I really wanted to bring up those points.
Well, Peter, thank you. And great names for these various climbs, by the way. And,
absolutely.
Go ahead, Brad.
I was just going to say that he's absolutely correct. Lake Willoughby up in northern Vermont has some of the biggest and baddest ice climbing in the entire East Coast. I mean, it's an amazing location.
But New Hampshire's often called a mecca for ice climbing, right, Peter? I mean, I know people come from all over the Northeast to climb here.
What New Hampshire has is some of the best easily accessible ice. Here we have Crawford Notch. It's just an amazing, amazing location, Mount Washington and Crawford Notch and stuff. And the ice climbs there are very easily accessible, as is Cathedral Ledge right in the center of North Conway here. So it's the kind of thing where you can literally, you know, park your car, walk 10 or 15 minutes, and have a selection of 30 or 40 different ice climbs.
Wow, that's a lot.
It's an amazing location. It's incredible. And that's one of the things that New Hampshire has, just this incredible variety of.
Well, and Brad, I have to wrap you up, but I do have to ask you one last question. Lots of unpredictable weather. It's freezing cold and then it's warm. I mean, what does that mean for your sport, ice climbing?
It's strange. Basically, there's no, if you've been ice climbing, I've been ice climbing since 1975.
Wow.
And so basically, you would have thought that I've seen it all, but that's not necessarily the case. But basically, the weather, it's strange. On very, very cold weather, then the big climbs, which are natural waterfalls with great volumes of water, tend to freeze up and be in really, really excellent condition. But when you get incredible cold, it almost like it shuts off the tap on a lot of other climbs, and they don't form as well and become very, very brittle. Whereas when you have rain events and stuff like that that feed the water source, sometimes that can create too much flow to freeze properly for the bigger climbs, but the smaller climbs come into shape. So basically, you get this kind of a tit-for-tat kind of thing where, you know, sometimes people think it's a bad season when actually it's not. There's just
it's interesting, given the psychology of ice. Brad, I've got to wrap you up there. I really appreciate you being with us. Thank you.
Certainly. Absolutely. Thank you very much for having me.
That's Brad White, longtime climber and guide from the Mount Washington Valley. He's director of the International Mountain Climbing School in North Conway. And this is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.